All right, well, thanks for having me back. it's one thing to come to a church once. But I mean, just a bit about us. I mean, you already know a lot about us in that we've been out in Lebanon 6 months now, and Claire is a grant writer, and me as a project manager, both working for our partner organisation, LSESD, the Lebanese Society for Educational and Social Development. They're doing so much great work with refugees and with children with learning difficulties, and they also work with education and youth work. So we're mainly out there to do capacity building. So we've not really got traditional roles, I think we mentioned last time, but we're really looking at business as mission and trying to work out, okay, what's you know, what can we offer in a business sense, in a behind the scenes kind of sense. So we plan to be out there for 2 years. There we go. But then three weeks in, Petra, we found out we were pregnant. So 3 weeks. It was the timing. God knows about timing. It was a great little surprise, and it's wonderful to have Petra. And we're really, really thrilled as parents. So this happened quite early on in our time in Lebanon. We found out. So we thought, okay, while we're there, we're going to be there for another kind of 5 months. Let's try and get as acquainted as possible with Lebanon, with the church. So we found a church to go to out there, and just with the country and the people. And so that when we go back, we're really planning to kind of hit the ground running, so we don't have to find an apartment or a car or, you know, get established. We can go straight into a church. We've got our apartment sorted. So we feel like we can really go and hit the ground running when we go back. So a little about what I wanted to talk about today was I have seven things. So seven things that have really stood out to us in the first 6 months of us being there. So some things that have wowed us, some things that that God's doing out in Lebanon, and maybe a couple of the more practical things as well that we've had to deal with, and really some of the challenges that Lebanon's facing. So number one, the Ministry of Reconciliation at work. We're seeing the story of the Good Samaritan lived out in Lebanon. You've probably heard a lot, well, you will have heard a lot about the Syrian crisis and the way Lebanon's opened its doors to over 1.5 million Syrian refugees. But there's so much of a complicated history that goes with that. There was a long and multifaceted civil war, actually, that in Lebanon that Syria had a big part to play in. And ended in 1990. But some of the stories we've heard of from some of the people in Lebanon is shocking in regards to the Syrians in Lebanon. So one of our friends, as he was growing up in the civil war, he remembers, or he recounts, a time when he had to on his way to school. There was one road. It wasn't that road, but it was in that area, Ain El Romani, where they had to run across the road, because if they didn't run, they could be picked off by a sniper. And these are children that we're talking about. And he'd regularly see, you know, he'd be out playing with his friends, and friends would be killed in front of him. So I mean, it's just the and this was again Syrian influence here in Lebanon. Another story of our friend who was about 6 months pregnant. It was towards the end of the war. Syria were kind of pulling out and dropping bombs as they went. So they had to flee their home, and they ended up running right into a Syrian attachment of soldiers. And they were right there in front of them, about to be shot. But then a Lebanese group came over the other side behind them and actually killed these Syrian soldiers right in front of them. And so just the trauma witnessed is really nothing we're used to, in the UK. And these are just two stories, and every Lebanese person has one. So as you can imagine, the Lebanese really have a good reason to hate Syrians and to you know, and the majority really don't like the fact that there's so many in their country. It's the equivalent, really, of, I mean, the refugee crisis is the equivalent, really, of around 20 million Germans moving to the UK 10 years after World War II. So it's that kind of, if you can, that helps you picture it a bit better. So most Syrians come without any food, money, or means to earn, and really, it's in such a small country, it makes such a massive difference. Yet our church and others, which are full of hurting people, are embracing the Syrians. It's been amazing, and this is the reconciliation I'm talking about. In that, you know, they're being the Good Samaritan. So in this story, the Syrians are actually the beaten man, and it's the church that are doing their best to bind the wounds and bring healing. So as with the story of the Good Samaritan, so many people look the other way. So fellow Muslims, the Lebanese government, the Syrian government, they just look away. But again and again, we hear stories of Christians stepping in to help, of the church stepping in to help and showing mercy. And as you can imagine, with a country only the size of Cornwall, there are so many displaced Syrians all over, everywhere. And Mansouria, where we're based, is no exception. And our church really has looked to embrace the Syrians that have come. So actually, one thing we've done is we put together an iftar meal. So iftar is how Muslims break the fast of Ramadan. And usually it's broken because they haven't eaten all day. It's broken in a quite a lavish, lots of food. But many of the Syrians can't actually afford to have that, to do that. So we actually provided a buffet kind of Lebanese meal for over 350 Syrian refugees, so they could break the fast in a traditional way, and you know, celebrate with lots of food, and it was really a chance for us to be able to bless the Syrian community in our little town. And actually, you can see me, I'm in the white shirt there, trying to stand between 350 hungry Syrians and the buffet bar. And that was not a good place to be. And it was a lot of shoving, a lot of pushing. But, you know, it was, yeah, they all got fed, which was great. Another thing we put on is a men's event. So we had over 100 men come, and we did games and had some prizes and food, and then a talk in Arabic. And I mean, these are just kind of some of the ways that God's bringing reconciliation between, you know, two very conflicting groups of people, the Lebanese and the Syrians. So number two, how much kids love sweets. So some of you, or you shared a bit about this in our blog, so some of you might have heard this story, but it seems no matter where you are in the world, it's a universal truth that kids do love sweets. And we've actually used it to solve a daily dilemma that we face on the streets of Beirut. And I know you probably face it here too. It's really what's the best way to engage with people in need? So, you know, when they ask for money. So, you know, you'll often see someone asking for money, begging. And it really just thinking, how can we engage in a godly way, in a way that Jesus would engage with those people? I mean, it's really heartbreaking the amount of children that roam the streets and beg at car windows. And it gives us such a predicament because we, you know, it's something we regularly discuss with others, with other mission workers. It's just, you know, we don't want to ignore them, and so many do. So many of these kids, you know, they'll knock on car windows and they won't even be acknowledged. And it's just, how do we engage when we don't speak the language, so it's hard to communicate? We are learning Arabic, but it's, you know, it can be tough. We don't know. We can't have a full conversation. And also, we've heard that if they are given money, the money's just given to the handlers at the end of the day. So they don't actually get to see it or use it. So what we did was we had a chat with Claire, and we decided to get a crate of water and a bag of sweets. So now that whenever, you know, we wanted to do something that should show God's love in a, you know, in just a small way to these kids. So now whenever a kid knocks on the window, we're able to wind it down with confidence, knowing that we can give them something. So, you know, give them a bottle of water or a sweet. And it's nice to be able to give them something that's not money, so that we know that just for 2 minutes, you know, they can really feel like a kid again. And the smiles we get are amazing. Just they see a lolly, and it's like, oh wow, it's like they're able to be kids again. And given, you know, want to be able to give them such a sense of worth and acknowledge them as children, and just really trying to be Jesus for them. Number three, meek can no longer be trusted. This is one of the things we learn. And sometimes as mission workers, the dilemmas we face are a lot more practical and day-to-day, and such as encountering some very strange foods, which poses all sorts of questions. Now, this, you know, I mean, we see, and I mean, meat is one thing that I love. In the UK, it's great. You know, we have, you've got your Sunday dinners, you've got your shepherd's pie, you know, cooked breakfast. And when someone says, oh, it's meat for dinner, you know you're always going to be all right. It's always going to be safe. However, in Lebanon, meat is a number of different things. And as you can see, this is actually two pork chops dressed as chicken. Now, being in the Middle East, I understand that they might need to be a bit more kind of sensitive about packaging, but I think this is taking it a bit far. Here's the next thing. This is called kibbeh, and this is raw mince. And we've been served it up a couple of times. I must admit, we both probably haven't had that much of it, because it certainly put hairs on your chest. It was it's quite an interesting dish. And then finally, I won't give you any more pictures other than this one. This is a bowl or a plate of small migratory birds whole. And we were being actually hosted at someone's house, we thought it would be rude if we didn't have one. So I did the admiral thing and stepped in. I said, "It's okay, Claire. I'll have one." I took one. I managed to knock the head off, so it was just the body. But I must admit, it was very bony, quite crunchy, and there wasn't a lot of meat on it. But sometimes it's the challenges we face are sometimes more cultural or physical. And we still have to just trust that God knows what's happening. And, it's going to be all right. He's watching over us, even if we are, eating small birds. So, number four, we're called to look for hope. Now, hope in the West is somewhat second nature. It's why so many people want to come to Europe. We have times and seasons of hopelessness, but we always try and find that smidgen of hope. We always try and find that bit that's going to, lead us on. And all our movies are based around it, and it's what we teach our kids, and our philosophies, are based on new days and that it will be all right in the end. However, in Lebanon, it's just not the case. And especially among Syrians, so many live without any hope of change. Apart from actually the ones that are getting on the dangerous boat journeys to come to Europe, they're the ones that, have a little bit of hope, because they think, if I get to Europe, that will be, I'll be able to do something with my life. I'll be able to create something. But actually the ones that stay are well aware that their circumstances won't improve. And they really do know that. And the Lebanese, they also don't hold out much hope for change. They all seem prepared for the worst. We went to a friend's house, and he started showing us his gun collection. All Lebanese have guns. They've got guns in their homes, and there's an expectancy that the next conflict is just around the corner, and they've got to be prepared for it, whether that be with Israel, whether that be with ISIS, whether that be another civil war. And that's not even to mention the levels of corruption in government that we've seen. Now, we followed the Brexit decision and while we were in Lebanon, and some of the political disillusionment that kind of went along with that campaign. And, you only have to look across the Atlantic right now to see the political disillusionment that's happening there with their choice of candidates. But really, in Lebanon, it's a whole new level. There was one story of a transport minister who he had actually ordered a shipment of fire extinguishers to come into the country. So, and then he went in and he changed the law to say everyone who drives a car in Lebanon must have a fire extinguisher in their car. So then he then sold all his fire extinguishers. And I mean, just there's just such a disillusionment with those in authority and with leaders in the country. And then coupled with that, there's an ongoing rubbish issue. This is the you might have heard of it, the river of trash that runs through Beirut. They actually decide to bag it into white bags to kind of cover it up a little bit. But as you can see, it's still, you know, it's massive. And really, it's seeing that, I mean, they see that things are getting worse, not better. And really, they don't have hope for tomorrow. So we didn't really know what our jobs would be when we went out there in a spiritual sense. Practically, we did. Practically, we knew that I was going to do project management and Claire was going to do grant and bid writing. And also, you know, we were going to you know, try and integrate into society and get to know people and all of that. But really, we've only just recently realized that that we want to carry the hope of Jesus, and we want to carry the hope for change in the country. And it's actually taken us coming home to realize this. Coming home, you know, I think in Lebanon we probably fell a little bit under the umbrella of hopelessness that maybe spiritually is out there. And it's taken us coming home and stepping back from the situation to help us to realize that what God's called us to go out there and do again. And we really feel we want to bring his hope back to Lebanon. We want to be carriers of his hope when we go back. So in Romans 15:13, just turn there and read it. It says, this is Paul praying. He says, I pray that the God who gives hope will fill you with much joy and peace while you trust in him. Then your hope will overflow by the power of the Holy Spirit. And that's really what we want. You know, Paul prays about God being our hope in all situations, in all circumstances. And we're having to learn that no matter kind of what our situation or what our circumstance, no matter what difficulty we face, by trusting in God's goodness and the truth of who he says he is, that we can get through anything and that we can continue to breathe. We can continue to breathe new hope into our circumstances. And then our hope or his hope in us will overflow to those around us. And that's what we want. And I mean, just a small story of this we met an American lady who came over to Lebanon for a visit, and she went up to one of the refugee camps and met a young man called Ahmed. Now, Ahmed was Syrian and was in school and education, but since he left the country about 4 or 5 years ago, he's had no education, just been in the camps and trying to, you know, get money, basically. And Brenda, our friend, met Ahmed. And then came back to us and said, I really want to be able to get him some books so he can study again. So at the time, I was working at the Beirut Baptist School and was able to speak to the librarian who had some old books she was throwing out and was able to get them and then hand them over through a number of different people to Ahmed. And it's just that kind of, it's just those small acts of kindness that's going to bring hope to Ahmed, the hope that he can learn again and that he can, you know, that it might not be a lot, but it's restoring. Sometimes it just needs to kind of be a spark that restores hope. And really, it's the small things that we can do rather than getting dismayed about the big things we can't. That's what we're learning. And so by trusting in God through all the challenges and futility that life may throw at us, and knowing that he's going to fill us with joy and peace to get through to the next stage. And we're learning in Lebanon that God is our anchor, you know, not the political system, not things around us, but God, and he'll carry us. And so many in Lebanon see hope as lost, yet we continue to see it as alive and believe that God is working to restore hope in Lebanon. And we just really want to be a part of that. So number five, the success of Discovery Bible Study. So friends of our church pioneer what's called DBS, DBS for short, or the acronym. And they're finding it's working really well among Muslim Syrian families. So DBS is peer-led Bible study. It's not preaching or teaching, but it's making scripture the authority for the group or the meeting. And opinion's actually not allowed, but it's only what's said in the Word and discussing only what's said in the Bible. Now, they recognize that more is needed once a commitment to Christ is made, but actually for initial exposure to Jesus in an approachable and non-confrontational way, it's really working. And actually, thousands of Muslims are coming to know Christ through this platform, particularly in the context of the refugee camps, particularly the Syrian families. And I think this is because they can actually connect with the story of Jesus. Because we look at the Gospels and they recognize the despair and the situation. And they know that Jesus has been through that. He was a refugee. You know, he had to leave Israel. And really, they can connect with that story. So one thing you can definitely be praying for Lebanese church leaders is that we will know, or they will know, how best to disciple the new Muslim background believers. So on one level, we've had to deal with quite a lot of culture shock going to Lebanon, especially, you know, being out there for only 6 months. People have said 6 months is the kind of mark where you can really start to feel settled. And so we went and 6 months, and we were actually starting to feel settled, and then we've come home. But you know, it can be disorientating, it can be frustrating, you know, not knowing how the basics work. You know, you can't, it's hard to get hold of milk in Lebanon, and, you know, it's just different things like that can be quite frustrating. So we've realized that actually many Muslim background believers are also trying to deal with culture shock by coming out of Islam, where lifestyles are regimented, they're disciplined and structured, like within the Muslim community. Churches are recognizing that and having to ask the question of how accommodating should we be of cultural practices, and, you know, how accommodating do we need to be and how accommodating should we be? I think it's probably something that even churches here deal with. So in the, you know, you can imagine that many different churches have many different approaches, and really trying to be accepting without compromising on our own beliefs. So when we welcome people into our church, how accepting are we if they don't fit our mold, if they don't fit kind of what we consider to be Christian? I mean, for example, some Muslim background believers prefer to continue praying 5 times a day at specific times. I mean, is that acceptable? They're praying to Jesus, but they're still kind of within that mold. And fasting and prayer rhythms can look so different in Islam. And as a church, we're recognizing that by keeping some customs, the transition into life with Jesus can actually be a lot smoother. And it's really grappling with finding the line between what's just cultural and acceptable to carry on as a Muslim background believer and what's Islamic and needs to be challenged. So these are just a couple of things we're looking at and dealing with as a church. And it's why we did the iftar meal, because we're looking really to engage. We're looking for engagement, not protectionism, and by putting walls up. And in all, we can't afford to shut new believers out just because they don't fit our own mold. And, you know, our number one calling is to love our neighbor. And, it says to love our neighbor, and it doesn't state what, you know, size or shape or culture they should be from. We're just supposed to love. So that's really some of the things we're looking at. Number six, education is bursting at the seams. So in the first instance, state schools are run badly due to high levels of corruption, as already mentioned. And therefore, education can sometimes get overlooked. So on top of this, there's a whole generation of Syrian children who are growing up without any education. And as it's not generally available in the camps, quite often the children are sent to the city to beg, as the parents either can't get work due to visa restrictions, or they're generally, you know, too ashamed to beg themselves. The kids will go in. And some schools have started teaching Lebanese children in the morning and Syrian children in the afternoon. And this is with no extra pay. They do this. And as you can imagine, the workload often becomes quite overwhelming. And it's the Syrian children in the afternoon that suffer, because the teacher's worn out, teacher's exhausted. Plus, Lebanon's a hot country. So actually, you know, teaching in the afternoon isn't done in general, because the heat in the classroom just gets a bit too much. And this doesn't even begin to take into account the actual mental health of refugee children. So one of the ministries we oversee is Smart Kids with Individual Learning Differences. And they're trying to run surveys in state schools to determine how many children actually suffer from PTSD, and really what can be done to deal with this and to help them with the trauma. And another one of our ministries we oversee is the Baptist Children and Youth Ministry. And they're actually partnering with a local orphanage in Beirut called Home of Hope. A Home of Hope is a place where street children who have no parents, they're taken by the authorities, and it's run by Christians. And the situation there is there's actually no safety net. There's no kind of social services. If you're an orphan, you're usually, you know, eventually you'll have to go out to the street if you have no parents. And you're then picked up by the police and then taken to one of these houses run by Christians. And the current situation with Home of Hope is that they have enough money to kind of house and clothe and meet the medical needs and, you know, feed the children, but they don't have the money to educate. So that's where the BCYM, the Baptist Children and Youth Ministry, are coming in, where they're teaming together to educate these kids. So again, this is they've created something called Hope Academy. Now, Hope Academy actually launched last month, and it's a brand new training facility specifically for these kids, where they can go and they can get a basic level of education, and then we feed them. And then we have another group in the afternoon. And it's really so we can give them some sort of apprenticeship opportunities, and some opportunities as they get kicked out of the home at 18 because they're not allowed to stay. There's really, if they've not got an education, there's no hope of finding work. They might be able to get some manual labor or something, you know, unskilled. But some of them can't even read or write. So this again is looking at how we can bring hope and how we can do that in Lebanon. So I've talked for a little while, so it's time for some audience participation now. So we were amazed really at the cost of things out there, and so just had got a quick bit of participation to see how much you think things might cost. So a medium-sized jar of Marmite. Now, you might love it or hate it. I know it's just gone up in this country, but you know, how much do you think that would cost in Lebanon? Any ideas? Five, a little bit more. Say again? £10. £10 for a jar of Marmite. And now we both love Marmite, but we've had to sacrifice our Marmite craving because we just can't justify paying £10 for it. Okay, now prenatal vitamins, so vitamin D, multivitamins, folic acid, you know, something we've had to purchase since we've been out there, all the vitamins you'd need for pregnancy. Bear in mind, it's free in the UK. How much do you think in Lebanon? Say again? 20, a bit higher. It's £50 a month for these basic vitamins. And then to have a car valet inside and out. Any ideas? Say again? 100? No. It's £3, yeah. £3. So what we've found is service is actually very cheap. Service in Lebanon is cheap, but commodities are really expensive. And on top of the medication that we had to get for Claire's pregnancy, we had doctor's appointments and blood tests as well, which worked out to be another £50 a month. So actually, all in all, it's roughly £100 a month if you get pregnant in Lebanon and you want to receive the same level of care as you would in the UK. Thankfully and, you know, luckily for us, we just about managed it. But as you can imagine, because wages in the service industry are so low, you know, only maybe they get paid about £10 a day, there's no way they can afford the commodities or healthcare that we would need to have the same level in this country. It's just too expensive. So kind of worryingly, health then starts to slip down the priority list. And for so many low earners, they're just looking at, you know, paying the rent and how to feed the family. So this actually means that there's a whole segment of society with no access to healthcare. And coupled with the ongoing rubbish problem I showed you earlier, it's going to bring a greater prevalence of disease. And actually, many Lebanese are afraid that this is going to bring an epidemic to the country that's not going to be easily dealt with. So definitely continued prayer and finance is needed for health education in Lebanon to really help reverse the increasing health gap between the rich and the poor. So in conclusion then, as you can see, Lebanon really needs your prayers. It's not in a good way, and people don't hold out much hope for improvement. And really, people have voted with their feet. Roughly around 4 million people live inside Lebanon, and there's 15 million that live outside Lebanon. So 15 million Lebanese people live in places like Brazil and America and Europe. And really, it shows that if you can afford it, you leave. And that's the mentality. If I can afford it, then I'll go and live somewhere else. So as you can imagine, there's a massive brain drain in Lebanon that, you know, it's the rich, it's the better educated that are able to afford themselves a better place to live. However, there is some really good stuff happening. As I've already mentioned, you know, some of the stuff. But Lebanon is a real shining light for Christians in the Middle East. Both... you know, it's really only one of the only truly safe places for Christians, apart from maybe Israel. And it's really the gateway to the Arab world, both physically and spiritually. Physically from its location, and spiritually for its because there's so many Arab Christians in Lebanon. So the organization we work for, LSESD, is not only working to improve livelihoods, as I've talked about, but also facilitate ministries that push Jesus to the forefront of society. So some of this is the Arab Baptist Theological Seminary continues to train and send missionaries and pastors to some of the most closed places in the Middle East. The Beirut Baptist School continues to hold tight to Christian values of collaboration and inclusion and without compromise, where their school population is over 90% Muslim. And the Arab Publishing House continues to finance and produce Christian literature in Arabic so that men, women, and children get to see and hear the word of God in their own language. Really, our job is just to help facilitate this vision. So as I've mentioned, we work in business. We work at looking at the gaps behind the scenes. Really, we're looking at how this message can be pushed further and can go to more people and how they can facilitate more and how we can make the organization more efficient and really we're from behind the scenes. And, we really can't do this without you. And I want to thank this church specifically for the support, not only in prayer, but also in finance that you've given us. It's enabled us to be in Lebanon and to do so much more. So I really want to thank you, both Claire and I, thank you for that. yeah, so if you would like to hear any more, then please talk to us afterwards, talk to me afterwards. I think I saw Claire come in somewhere. Petra's here too, so you get to have a little... This is actually Petra's first visit to church, so there you go. So, yeah, it's been great. So, yeah, thank you for everything, really, and thank you for the support, and we'd love to talk to you afterwards.